And now it's time for another episode of Gangland Wire True Crime Stories with retired Kansas City, Missouri Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Thanks, Aaron. This is Gary. Welcome back to hear the exciting conclusion of our five-part series on the Spiro versus the Savella War. Actually, there was a book by Jimmy Breslin called The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight. This is the gang that bungled the bombing, could not detonate the bomb right. We're in the deep, dark confines of Studio 4, the home studio for the Big Dumb Fun Show. My friend and co-host Aaron Gnerk is here. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
And you know, to hear independent music and learn about the independent film scene, visit www.bigdumbfunshow.com and listen in. Aaron has some fine stuff. You know, I found out that Aaron receives and plays music created by musicians from all over the United States just looking for a venue. So listen to some original cutting-edge stuff and maybe help discover the next Elvis or Jerry Lee Lewis. And you know, a little commercial for myself, I guess. I always have a hard time pimping myself out, but...
Don't forget about ganglandwire.com.
See, I'll let Aaron pimp me out.
And your documentary, Gangland Wire. With original wiretaps and audio from the actual men who did the acts. Nick Savella, Tuffy DeLuna, Cork Savella. Download the app. Tell us about your app, Gary.
My app is called Kansas City Mob Tour. If you want to take a mob tour of Kansas City sites, go to your favorite app store and search for Kansas City Mob Tour, and you'll find it for a small token price of $1.99. You'll be able to see clips from my movie. You'll be able to see where Nick Savella lived. You'll be able to see where somebody tried to kill him one night. You'll be able to see where Johnny Lazio was killed. You'll see the bullet holes at the Union Station. I make recommendations on places to eat, and one of these places, if you eat at it, it's an Italian place. I was in there one night, and wife and I were in there, and every mob book in the city was sitting around a table having a merry old time eating lasagna and mostaccioli and Italian sausage, and it's great Italian food, too. You walk in this place, and you feel like you walk back into the 50s and hear Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett music on the jukebox. So get the Kansas City Mob Tour app. Well, you know, Aaron, if you remember, when we left off last time, it was the morning of May the 16th. That's the one-year anniversary of when Mike Spiro was killed. And his brothers, Carl and Joe Spiro, believe that Tuffy DeLuna organized and participated in that killing. And the Kansas City police have an informant named Lyle Neal. And Joe has told Lyle Neal that he wants him to pick him up on this anniversary date. And Lyle knows that Joe has a bomb that he wants to kill Tuffy with, and we don't know where that bomb's being stored yet. And we know he tried it once and it didn't work right because the antenna was too short. Tuffy had it placed underneath his car, and Joe's out there punching the plunger, and Tuffy just drives off, leaving the bomb sitting in the street. And Joe doesn't go up and pick it up. He sends one of his underlings, a guy named Conrad Metz, who has to run up and pick up this sack with 6 or 8 sticks of dynamite in it that was some malfunction in the operation. I don't know if I'd want to do this, but this is why Lyle Neal wanted out of this operation, but he was in it.
He was afraid he was going to be the next guy
to run up and pick up the bomb that didn't work, and it'd go off the next time.
Now, when they tested the bomb, you said they had to actually test it.
It
didn't go off the first time. They had to figure out why that was.
Right.
Would they actually detonate, like they'd have a plunger remote and detonate like a stick of dynamite somewhere out in the country where they could do it?
No, because that would blow up the mechanism. Here's what you do. You pull the blasting cap out of the dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
There's two wires that go to the blasting cap. So you pull the blasting cap out and undo it, and you take those wires that go to the blasting cap, and you touch them to a light bulb out of a flashlight. And so whenever you hit the detonator, it sends a small electric charge.
That would detonate the blasting cap.
The blasting cap. Well, in this case, it's not hooked to a blasting cap. It's hooked to a light bulb, and that's how you test it. You start off 50 yards away and it won't work. You go to 40 yards away and it won't work. You go to 30 yards away and it won't work. You go to 20 yards away and you hit the plunger and the button, the light bulb lights up. So that's
but that becomes kind of dangerous to be that close.
Well, you don't have the blasting cap hooked up to it.
No, I'm just saying when you actually would have to use the bomb.
Sure, right. And so they had to put a longer antenna on it, on the receiving device. So they figured out how to make it work. Joe has ordered Lyle Neal to come by and pick him up on this anniversary date. Lyle Neal's told the police, we want to end this. The police and the ATF, they want to end this. They want to get the bomb, but you got to figure out where the bomb is, and you need a little more evidence. You need Joe Spiro really close to that bomb or in possession of it in order to make the case. Otherwise, you just got Lyle Neal's word against his. We had one little recording, and it wasn't very good. Matter of fact, I had a copy of that, and it was so bad I couldn't make it out. So that's where we are, and we want to wrap it up. And so why don't you play this? We have found a stolen car that Joe has hidden, and we know that's the car that they're going to use, but we don't know where the bomb is yet. Play that Clark Plant beeper. They were going to put a beeper or a hound dog or an electronic tracking device
on
that
car. This two-tone Buick?
Right.
The decision was made to place a beeper or transmitter on the car so that once they enter the car and if they start moving, we could keep track of them and possibly locate the bomb at that given point. Once the decision was made to put the hound dog transmitter on the car, because it was my case, I was the chosen one, and we waited several hours for it to stop raining, and then I went and slid under the car, and unbeknownst to me at the time, where I placed the transmitter was directly under where the bomb was located that was still hooked up and ready to go.
So, wow. Detective Hamilton had put himself at great risk unknowingly because this beeper is an electronic device that sends out an electronic signal. And about 6 inches above it, inside the trunk of this car, unbeknownst to him or anybody else at the time, there is a bomb that is triggered by electronic signals. But, you know, all's well that ends well, as they say, and they actually parked a surveillance van next to that car for the next several hours, and they would not park next to that car if they'd known the bomb was in it, that's for sure. But
they never actually looked inside the car.
They didn't know it was
even
in the trunk.
Even though they planted the
hound dog, they knew Joe was going to use that car. Joe had hidden, Lyle Neal had told him Joe had stolen a car and hidden it in these bottoms and finally found out where it was, and that's when they put the beeper on. They thought Joe was going to go get the stolen car and then go somewhere else and get the bomb. And so that's why they wanted to follow the stolen car.
Mm-hmm.
They also knew that stolen car would be the one they'd use when they go kill Tuffy. That was another reason to have the beeper on. You did not want to lose that car. It's the morning of May the 16th. Lyle Neal arrives at Joe Spiro's house on lawn about 10 a.m. And it's kind of early for most criminals. They usually don't get up till about noon because they stay up till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And it's over in the northeast part of Kansas City. It's an old neighborhood filled with bungalows and two-story shirtwaist homes. And it's kind of a changing blue-collar neighborhood. We've got guys all around by this time, and there must have been like probably 12 or 15 detectives in surveillance and had the airplane up and had the beeper car going, the receiving unit for the beeper, and Joe's getting dressed. And so Neal walks in, and Joe points to a Winchester Model 12 12-gauge shotgun and says, "Hey," he said, "unjam that. I can't get this thing to work." Well, that's probably the shotgun that he shot up Tuffy's house with. So Neal goes to work on the shotgun to unjam it and get it operating. And pretty soon Joe comes back out and he's ready to go, but he complains he can't find his gloves. He needs some gloves, but he can't find them, and they go ahead and leave. He tells Neal to drive down the East Bottoms and go down on 4219 Gardner, actually, and that's a parking lot of this trucking company dock where the stolen car is. They get down to this nondescript kind of two-tone brown Buick. We're sitting there watching that. The police are, and I wasn't, but some of these other guys were, and the White Collar Crime Squad and ATF agents. And we learned later that car had been sitting there for 6 months just waiting to be used. The guys in the surveillance van, they watch Joe, and he puts some socks on his hands, and he gets out of Lyle's pickup, and Lyle's got a pickup. He gets some keys out. Joe gets some keys out, and he opens up the Buick's trunk, and he takes out a brown paper sack, and he gets back in the Buick, and then he indicates for Lyle Neal to get out of his truck and join him inside the Buick. So once Joe gets inside, or Lyle Neal gets inside the Buick with Joe, Joe takes a styrofoam box with six sticks of dynamite out of it with an electronic mechanism hooked up to it. There's the bomb. And we're sitting about 8 feet from this in the surveillance van.
They're just in another van parked in the same lot, and these guys aren't paying any attention.
Right. Yeah, you got two-way glass on it, and so you're just watching, and he's not paying any attention. Joe, again, is going to give it one more test, and Lyle Neal, I'm sure by this time, is shitting bricks, because he gets the bomb out, he pulls the wires out of the blasting caps and unhooks the blasting cap and gets a automobile light bulb, and he touches the wires to the light bulb, and he hands a sending unit to Lyle Neal and says, here, press a button on this. So Lyle Neal, you know, what's he going to do? You know, say, oh, I'm out of here. No, you know, he's committed now.
Now he's got to push the button.
He pushes the button, and, you know, the light bulb goes off, and actually Neal said the current was so strong it burned out the light bulb. Joe's happy. This bomb's ready to go. Now, what is kind of begs the question is, how come he didn't try it at distance? For some reason, again, these are bungling bombers. He didn't go back and try it at distance. He tried it all within the same car, but he's convinced that it's going to work now. Play that Clark test the bomb audio. Clark will tell you a little bit about what happened.
Lyle pointed out to us a stolen car, which was down in the East Bottoms, the trucking area of Kansas City, and identified a car that they were going to use that was stolen, and allowed us ample time to set up a surveillance on the vehicle. The next morning, Joe and Lyle Neal showed up. They got in the car. They did not start the car. Joe reaches under the seat and pulls out a paper sack with the bomb. And Joe disconnects, according to Lyle, Joe disconnects the electric blasting cap, takes a light bulb and hooks it up to the wires that was leading to the blasting cap, flips the switch on the servo motor, the light bulb lit, in fact burned it out, and he confirmed to Lyle Neal that the bomb does work and they will be within range on the next attempt.
So, that's right out of the words of the man that was put the electronic sending unit about 6 or 8 inches from this bomb. During this little meeting inside the stolen car, Joe Sparrow tells Neal about his entire plan. He's not shared this before. He said, well, he got the bomb working now, and he says, what I want to do, I'm going to take this inside the Villa Capri when Tuffy and some of those others are there. And I want to do it, you know, today, hopefully tonight. I just got to catch him down there. And he tells Neal he wants him to get a gun and go with him. And he said, Joe told him, he said, once that bomb goes off, he says, you and I are going to go on inside and we're going to kill everybody that's remaining alive there. And Lyle Neal didn't know this was going to be expected of him for sure. So,
Lyle Neal, not actually a killer?
No, he's not a killer. He's a burglar and a pimp. And, he did that little bit for transporting stolen securities, but he was not a killer. He takes Joe back. Joe's ready to go. Joe wants to go back home, so then Lyle's able to get away from him. He meets up with Clark and J.D. Johnson, and when he tells them that, they now know where the bomb is. They now have seen Joe Sparrow in possession of that bomb.
They didn't stop him.
No. He's back home now. But
it wasn't enough for him to see him.
Well, they didn't know exactly what happened. They knew he had something in his hands in there.
Yeah.
The best they could say is he got something out of the trunk, he got in the car with Lyle Neal, and he had something in his hands, and they were messing around with something, the best they could say. But then they get Lyle Neal, and he says, here's what you just saw.
Yeah.
So now they got it, and they got the bomb. So they've got everything but Carl Sparrow. They've got Joe, rock solid, airtight.
Well, when they did that, how did Lyle Neal get away? Weren't they both in the car?
But yeah, Joe asked Lyle to take him back home.
So they left the stolen car
there.
They
left it down there with the bomb in it. when he meets up with them, says, hey, the bomb's in that car. They moved the surveillance van away a respectable distance. And they've already got teams ready to go and search warrants all prepared. They just need a judge's signature on them and maybe some final dotting of the I's and crossing of the T's and a final statement from Lyle Neal that, yeah, the bomb is inside that car. And Joe Spiro and I just looked at it, and they got the statements from the officers that said, yeah, we saw Lyle Neal and Joe Spiro get something out of the trunk of that car and do something with it inside the car. So they've got enough. They can't wait any longer. You can't try to gather any more evidence to try to get Carl Spiro. You've got to go after Joe. Joe's the best you're going to get. And that's just how it is. So kind of like the vice president during 9/11, Lyle Neal is whisked away to an undisclosed secure location. And he stays there, and he ends up in the witness protection program, actually, and still in it today if he's still alive. Search warrant teams are ready, and they got search warrants, and they go down and they get the bomb squad, and they go down and take the possession of the bomb intact. I've got great photos of it today, and dismantle
so actually,
it.
They break into the car, you're sitting right in the parking garage,
sure,
find the bomb in the brown paper bag.
Yep. Pull the blasting caps out of the sticks of dynamite and separate and remove the dynamite away from the blasting caps by a ways.
Where was the transmitter?
It was in the car.
It was in the car as well?
The whole setup was in the car, just waiting for Joe to come back down and get in the car and drive it down to the Villa Capri, take it inside and set it off.
How could Joe just walk into the Villa Capri?
Well, I mean, it's just a public place. You just walk in.
And no one would think anything, even though
it's
Joe Spiro.
Well, sure, they would say, what the hell's he doing in there? And, you know, what he would do, he'd walk in, he'd set the sack down, he'd walk back out and hit the plunger, and then go back in and kill her. That was his plan.
Yeah.
He had already tried this long-distance cool thing where you put it underneath the car and are slick, and he couldn't pull that off, so that was his best plan. Was to go in and set it off in the Villa Capri and then go back in and kill anybody that was still alive. So
With Lyle Neal,
yeah. When
Lyle Neal slips away, like, we'll meet up a little later on.
Sure, yeah, he didn't really slip away. Joe just wanted to go back home, and Joe says, I'll get hold of you later. And Lyle Neal's by himself, so he gets hold of J.D. and Clark, and Clark Hamilton says, here's what's going on. So we got the case made. Do the Clark takedown audio.
Joe testing the bomb, and within an hour or two, Lyle Neal indicated that Joe Spiro was all worked up and that it was going to be happening quickly because of the anniversary of the shooting that the Spiros were involved in 1 year to the date down at the Virginia Tavern. And then we found out the bomb was in the car. We immediately went for search warrants for the vehicle and acquired the bomb. We had the bomb squad come in, and they disarmed the bomb. The decision was made at that time, then this is the time everybody has to go.
All right, so we've got everybody taken down now. You know, and detectives always do follow-ups. So Clark went to interview Tuffy DeLuna about this threat on his life and ask him a few questions. But
they didn't actually, they took Joe down at his house?
Sure, Joe's under arrest. Joe's down to the federal courthouse right now. All of them are down to the federal courthouse by now.
And then they just kind of casually go over to Tuffy DeLuna.
Yeah, sure, go over to Tuffy and say, okay, here's what we've done. We've uncovered this threat. We understand that he came by and tried to shoot at you in front of your house. Have you got anything to say? It's just kind of your normal. You would do that as a normal follow-up.
Did you know that somebody was trying to kill you?
Right, right. And you know, you see how Tuffy works. Play that Clark Tuffy.
Throughout the investigation, I had the opportunity to go see Mr. DeLuna. And he made it quite clear at the beginning of the interview that he did not talk to law enforcement whatsoever.
And that was one of the shortest interviews on record, I guess. But that's your problems in working the mafia. They do not talk to the police, even when it might be in their interest. He's going to take care of it himself if he has to. This isn't over with yet.
Yeah, they're still trying to get...
Joe's out on bond.
So now at this point, they've bailed him out.
They bailed him out. He's got a federal indictment pending. A year later, October the 6th, 1970, this is May of 1978, October the 6th, 1979, they're found guilty. But Joe Spiro and Conrad Metz, conspiring to murder Tuffy DeLuna, possession of the bomb. But Joe appeals, so he's out on appellate bond. And on June 20th, 1980, the day before the appellate court would eventually uphold his conviction, actually, he was not. The case was that good, and he did not get out on appeal. Joe Spiro visits a storage locker in Liberty, and I think he probably knew they were going to uphold his conviction. And after they uphold his conviction, then he's going to have to turn himself in for his sentence. I remember what his sentence was. It was pretty long, in the double digits. But he has a storage locker up in Liberty, Missouri, which is a suburban city about, 20 miles north of downtown, 25 miles. And he walks into the storage locker area, and a hellacious explosion goes off, and Joe Spiro's body flew 90 feet in the air, according to the reports I read. And the physical evidence revealed he was just outside his locker unit at the time of this explosion. And forensics could not really determine if this had been a bomb he was carrying or if it came from inside, or they weren't too sure because it was such a horrific explosion, did so much damage. And about 10 years later after that, this is 1980, of 1990, there's an FBI informant that was pretty good. It's Bobby Jean Jones, I believe, and he was a really good jewelry thief, and they had a case on him, and he went in the witness protection program, so he was filling them in on a lot of things that happened.
Well, because they originally had like 100 sticks of dynamite.
Yeah, they did, and this is where they were. This other dynamite was down in this storage locker. We didn't know
in Liberty, Missouri.
In Liberty, and Lyle Neal didn't know where it was. They didn't tell anybody where it was. Joe knew where it was, but he was smarter than to tell everybody all of his business. Like, he didn't tell Lyle Neal the whole plan until he was ready to go do it. He didn't hip him to the whole plan and where the bomb was until the last minute.
Yeah.
So, and these guys are reasonably smart.
But he didn't walk up to the locker thinking it was going to blow up.
No, he walked up there to get something out of the locker. And we thought it was an accidental explosion at the time, that he was maybe messing around with his bomb and it went off accidentally. But 10 years later, this FBI informant tells the real story, that a guy named Larry Tuso and Johnny Joe Kalia, who were guys that did stuff together, did crime together, had been told that Joe Spiro had this large cache of dynamite, and in order to please the Savellas and make the Savellas' life a little easier, they rigged a device that caused that stored dynamite to explode just as Joe approached. But
anybody could have approached it.
Well, they knew that Joe was going to approach it.
So were they like, you think they triggered it remotely?
Yes, these guys are smart enough that they did not.
I mean, must have followed him to know where the storage locker was at.
Right. By this time, they had somebody next to him. That's how this works.
They probably had been in the storage locker because they would have had to rig it.
Johnny Joe Kalia was an expert thief. He could have picked the lock easily and seen it was in there. He could have planted a bomb in there. They could have had an informant close to Joe. They work just like the police do. They get informants on their enemies if they can. They probably had, by this point in time, they had some informant that was close to Joe and that would maybe call him and tell him, Joe's on his way up to the storage locker now. Somehow they knew it was coming. They triggered it as he walked up. They would never take the chance of killing an innocent party. A man's got to have a code. You don't ever kill no civilians. It's okay to kill some other criminal, but don't kill any civilians. That's the code. And it draws too much heat. You start causing collateral damage, and you're going to have a ton of law enforcement come down on top of you.
But when it's somebody who's a known criminal like Joe Spiro.
Right, you don't have so much heat come down on that.
What about Carl Spiro?
Same thing, and he's still out there. He's got him a little used car lot by that point in time. In 1982, a couple years later, Nick Savella's in jail on an old gambling charge, and everybody else is under indictment. Tuffy and Corky are under indictment for skimming from Las Vegas casinos, and Corky and Tony Ripe are visiting Nick up at Leavenworth, and they had bugged the visiting area. Now, I don't have this tape either. It never got put in as evidence, so I couldn't get it, but I did have the transcript, and they were talking about Carl Spiro, and Tony Ripe tells him, he says, he leaves that house every day about 11. Nick said, what are you going to do, put a thing under it? Nick later said, I want to know about it when it happens. That way I'll know how to react. This is in 1982, and Nick's about ready to die, but he wants to clean up all this old business. And so the first thing they do, they talk about putting it under it. A close associate of Carl Sparrow's was a guy named Lester Moore. He was a gambler, and for some reason, he always liked Carl Sparrow. He always provided him employment, although Carl didn't have to show up. But if you called up there and say, oh, yeah, he's a car salesman here, and he would go up there once in a while, but he didn't really work up there. And Lester Moore provided ease and comfort, shall we say, for Carl Sparrow for some reason. Carl probably had something on him, and said he was a sports gambler, and he owed a lot of money to this fellas at the time, as I found out later. Somebody put a bomb with, like, I don't know, it was like 25 or 30 sticks of dynamite underneath Lester Moore's car. And he came out, and it didn't go off. It had one of these plunging units, so when he sat in his car, the car went down onto the bomb, but for some reason it didn't go off. I talked to the bomb guy that had that, and he said, you know, they just didn't hook one wire up right.
But they had been able to get to him and get to his car
to
actually put something into it.
Right. He was up at a girlfriend's house, and they knew enough about him and what kind of car he drove that they tried to kill him. And you know what's interesting about that is, as one of the Sabella mobsters, Willie the Rat Camisano, at once overheard, you know, here's how you take down Carl Sparrow. It's like taking down a big tree. You take off the limbs first. And so that's what they were doing. They took out Johnny Brocato, if you remember before. They took out Joe Sparrow. They tried to take out Lester Moore because Lester Moore always provided him with money and a place to look like he was working and cars and whatever Carl wanted. And they just screwed up on Lester Moore. But finally, in January 1984, I had just gotten promoted to sergeant, was out working dog watch and left the intelligence unit. And I get up in the morning and I read the paper and there's a big spread across the front. Carl Sparrow killed in an explosion. And that wasn't an exact headline, but something like that. And he had a little used car lot called Five Star Autos, and he was inside his little shack that they'd built on that and on the front of it. And he was supposedly talking to the new husband of Joe Sparrow's widow. She had gotten remarried, and this new husband reports to the police. You know, he said, "I don't know what happened. The phone just went dead." And this little shack that he was using as office that had a wheelchair ramp. I remember this had a wheelchair ramp. Exploded, and that was the last of the Sparrow brothers. There was a remote control device that somebody set up the street and watched him pull up, go inside, roll his wheelchair inside this little office and hit that plunger, and that was the last of Carl Sparrow.
What was the story about the used car lot where Carl was killed?
Just before I got promoted, we were watching Carl down there quite a little bit just to see who his people were and see if anybody was still stalking him. And so I'm sitting up the street about two blocks away and watching down through some trees. And I noticed there was a little hubbub out in front of that shack and several young guys, and they were looking back up toward me, and one of them kind of pointed up there. And all of a sudden, one of them jumped in a car, and he spun out as he headed out of the driveway. And I thought, oh, shit, they're coming after me. So I took off and got up to Independence Avenue from this about 9th Street. That car lot was at 12th Street, and I was about 10th Street, I guess. And
you'd just been sitting in your car.
Just sitting in my car watching, and, you know, if I could, you know, I had some binoculars. If I pick up a license number, I'd write it down and just see who was coming and going. And so I got out, and all of a sudden they're behind me up on Independence Avenue trying to get up next to me. And see, they think I'm one of the Sabella hitmen is who they think. They don't really realize I'm the police, I'm pretty sure. And I played the game with them. I mean, I don't know what they'd have done if they'd got me pulled over. I got stopped once like this, and the guys walked up to me, and they were acting all tough, and I just held up my, I had my gun down underneath the side, out of sight by the window, and I held up my badge, and I said, "I'm the police," and they said, "Oh, okay," and they left. So these guys are trying to catch me and get up next to me and run me off the side, and they were chicken, though. We got up to a red light, and they just got up behind me, and I just ran the red light. And there wasn't any cross traffic coming, and I ran a red light, and they seemed to be afraid to run the red light, and they just sat there, and I got away from them on that one. But
you never know what was going to happen.
You didn't know what was going to happen, you know. I would have had to get the badge out quick.
Especially if they would confuse you with somebody who was from the Sabella outfit.
That was the danger. If they thought I was a hitman from the Sabella outfit or just a scout out trying to get a pattern on Carl Sparrow, because they did that stuff all the time. All the Sparrow brothers are dead. None of their descendants seem to follow in the same path some of the Sabella descendants have. And Nick dies. Carl and Corky Sabella and
Nick
Tuffy.
Nick dies in jail.
Yeah, he dies in jail. Corky and Tuffy are indicted for the skimming, and they have a trial, and Cork ends up dying in prison, and Tuffy got out just about 3 or 4 years ago, and he died shortly after he was released. And several of the grandsons of Cork Sabella were arrested for participating in an online sports betting operation a few years back. And he had another grandson, I think his name was Tony. He was arrested. He set up a company that was job was to refill ATM machines. And he had this contract, and he had guys working for him, but this gave him access to all this cash. And I just heard a report on this from a guy the other day that they were stealing $25,000 a month out of these ATM machines and did this for like a year before they got caught. I don't know how you cover that up for a year, but they did it for a year or so before they got caught. And, you know, the modern mob today, I know that there's a couple of guys convicted of arson for hire at the Hereford House, a local restaurant. And I remember them when they were young. One of them wanted to be a mob guy from the time he was 16, 17 years old. And arson for hire usually is a mob operation.
Well, the one guy was Italian for sure.
Yeah, both of them were Italian, actually.
Not full-blooded?
One of them may have been half-blood. I think one of them was half-blood. The other guy was full-blooded. And
didn't he drive for Nick?
He may have a little bit. I can't really remember. See, Nick Sabella had a regular driver named Pete Tamburello. And then, I left in 84, so as this guy was just coming up to do that. So I can't remember if Nick was gone by then, but he may have been a driver for somebody else because he was definitely involved back from the earliest days. But there's not really much going on. You know, the loss of the really Machiavellian, bright, intelligent elder statesmen like Nick and Tuffy and even Corky. Corky was a blunt force trauma kind of guy, but he was smart enough to play it cool. And Nick sure was, and Tuffy really was. And they lost all that steady stream of cash money for the casinos. They lost any influence they had over the Teamsters Union. And so they don't have enough money to buy politicians anymore. And politics has cleaned up quite a little bit out of the 50s and 60s in Jackson County. And some people would argue with me on that. But they're certainly not influenced by the mob anymore. They're more influenced by the payday lending corporations than anything. And the big banks and Wall Street, they've got all the politicians bought off now. And I'm researching for my next series right now, and I hope you've been entertained and enlightened about how the mafia works, and in this particular case is many examples of how these professional criminals work. The next story, I think, will be the story of the bank robbers who were foiled in a plot to kidnap Muriel Kaufman. That's a really interesting story. I also have a story about a Ku Klux Klan investigation here in Kansas City I was part of. I've got the life and times of Jimmy Duarte. He was the last of the old-time mobsters. Kind of, he was my career case was Jimmy Duarte, and other than these other things. But I spent a lot of time on Jimmy Duarte, and you've got
some true crime stories about him.
I got some about him, and I've got one about a serial killer and rapist that we mounted a 2-month-long surveillance where we worked 12 hours a day following this guy around, and it's got an unusual twist at the end. And I hope he's still in jail today. When I start this research on this, I'm going to make sure. Actually, I'm going to try to see if I can get him to give me a telephone interview out of the penitentiary. I don't know how that works, but that would be an interesting thing to do. So I'm going to work on
seeing if he'll actually do a phone interview.
Yeah, and I was part of that surveillance on him. It was a very scary nights that we spent out there following this guy around. He was a scary dude, and he just walked around the city and prowled and prowled and prowled and stalked and. It was interesting. So, you know,
how many victims did he have?
I have to research it. I know of the one he went down on, then he got released on a technicality, and that's when we got on him. But there were several before that. I can't remember. Maybe four or five before that. His victim were elderly white women who lived in Midtown Kansas City. We found out he was back out on this technicality, and we locked down on him on a surveillance. After one appeared that looked like it was his handiwork. At first, we didn't know he's back out. And then this one elderly white woman was found strangled and raped. And the sex crime sergeant looked at, read that report, and he said, "Oh my God, is Vernon Tatum around?" And he checked, and he wasn't. He was out of the penitentiary, and so that's when we locked down on him. And there was one more after that, but
you eventually caught him, and he didn't get out on a technicality.
It's a pretty unusual twist, but we hope he's still in jail today. Go to my blog, www.ganglandwire. Tune in to the Big Dumb Fun Show and just Google Big Dumb Fun Show. And he's on a Monday nights live.
7 to 10.
And hear the latest cutting edge independent music from all over the United States and learn about the independent film industry here in Kansas City, particularly.
Well, but forget that. What about Gangland Wire?
You got Gangland Wire. I got a blog. You'll see a few people from the old days making rather cryptic comments, and you'll see some of the relatives of some of these people complaining about what I'm doing. Go to the iTunes or Google Play Store and type in search for Kansas City Mob Tour app. Kansas City Mob Tour will be the word you'd use, and for a small price of $1.99, you can take your own mob tour of Kansas City, see clips from my film. See clips from another film that a friend of mine did called Black Hand Straw Man.
By Terrence O'Malley.
He was kind enough to let me use some little clips from that film to tell stories about the places that my app, which was complete with map stories and pictures about what it looked like back then and what it looks like today, and experts to tell you about what went on, some clips from wiretaps, and you can sit outside of where the wiretaps were recorded and listen to what the wiretap and listen to the wiretaps. So it's a lot of fun. I've had a lot of positive feedback. Just make sure you enable the map function. allow the app to access the map function. Otherwise, the map won't work, I found out.
And, of course, you can buy Gangland Wire, the documentary.
Yes, you can.
Right there at ganglandwire.com.
And if anybody wants a speaker about the mob, I'm available for that, too. I'll do anything here to talk about the mob. As well as my childhood hero would say, happy trails to you until we meet again. Good night, Aaron.
Good night, Gary.